Finally, we've got round to doing a podcast about the Celtic managerial stuff. This is a football fans podcast from the people behind CelticUnderground.net. Like many people listening to this, I have really been busy at work, and so apologies for the delay in getting podcasts out. It's just trying to find the time. Anyway, got a couple of guys together and we are talking about the whole managerial situation at Celtic, the Eddie Howe rebuttal and the Ange Postecoglou imminent appointment, it seems. And the game series will continue shortly. Anyway, enough of me. This is Sean, Huddleston, St. Anthony and Hellboy. There's been a dearth of Celtic Underground podcasts, not a dearth of podcasts. Do you know, actually, that's just as I'm saying this, that's maybe a topic of conversation, to talk about the change in social media landscape of fan media and some elements of fan media filled with their own self-importance. But that's by the by. So we've not done a podcast for a while, so I thought I'd get some guys around to talk about the Eddie Howe thing and Ange Postecoglou, if that's how you pronounce his name, whose impending arrival. So I've got St. Anthony, Hullboy and Sean Huddleston. How's everyone doing?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I was doing okay, and then I was walking along Polishaw's Road and heard his bars reopened, so the world is right again. The world is right.
And I can just see out the window, Andy, that the whole Riviera appears to have the sun shining brightly.
Yep, splitting sky today. Very nice.
Brexit can't take that away from you, buddy.
We've not done a podcast since. I'm going to let a little secret out. I did one of the game podcasts with a couple of people. And to save time, because I've been exceptionally busy with work and stuff like that, we then did a 20-minute Isn't It Great That Eddie Howe's the New Celtic Manager podcast, just so that I had one available to go up, because it was so certain that Eddie Howe was going to become the Celtic manager. So I'll start with you, Andy. What's your thoughts on the Eddie Howe debacle? What's your thoughts on that?
The saga. I've got the box set. It's unbelievable. I think his name first got mentioned in mid-February. And from that time onwards, there was kind of more and more of a drip feed of his name. And I'm sure, like the rest of you, there were texts and WhatsApp messages doing the rounds about, yep, he's definitely going to be coming. He just needs to see out his contract with Bournemouth when their season finishes. He's going to be bringing his backroom staff. There may be some problems with the backroom staff, but that's all going to be sorted. So I think, like a lot of other supporters, I was getting slightly niggled that he wasn't being announced. But at the same time, I was kind of feeling fairly relaxed that he was going to end up being our manager. So when the bombshell dropped, well, literally just a few days ago, I really couldn't believe it, because if he strung us along, then that says something about the Celtic board in terms of their competencies. And if he hasn't strung us along, then that suggests that something at our end has gone wrong in his eyes as to why he's no longer interested and doesn't want to come. But to have spent that amount of time, you know, I mean, we're into, what, 102, 103 days now without a manager, and we've got two chief execs. How's that?
Well, we don't anymore. Peter Lowell finished at 5 o'clock on Friday. Well, at some point on Friday, apparently.
Oh, right, okay.
Well, I wonder where his leave and do was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is, it's not been formally I don't think that's been formally announced, because technically, I'm sure his contract's paid up to the end of the year, whatever, but apparently Friday was actually his last day, which is part of the reason it prompted me to do this, because I now have hope that if that's the situation, then maybe it's to clear the way for Dom to make all these announcements at the beginning of next week. So, Sean, what's your take on it?
On the Eddie Howe situation?
On the Eddie Howe situation.
I was, you know, I don't want to be one of these guys that say I told you so, but I was always a little bit circumspect that he would ever come up to Glasgow, for God's sake. This is a guy that got homesick in Burnley, wasn't he? I think he quit there after just a few months.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised that he was putting himself forward to come up this far north. I was also a little bit circumspect about his actual record. He had a reputation for being a progressive coach. Was he that successful? Arguably not. But then I can see both sides of the argument there. You know, he kept Bournemouth up for, what, 2-3 seasons, I think. But coming back to your point, Andrew, I think this just shows how much the Celtic board overplayed their hand. They should have put this deal to bed either way. Months ago, and they've been shown up to be complete amateurs in this respect. And it also, I fear for Postecoglou, beg your pardon, in the sense that he is now going to be completely saddled with this second choice label, isn't he? Regardless of, you know, whether people really back him or get behind him or whatever the case may be, I feel quite sorry for him in that respect as well. And again, that's another mistake that the Celtic board have to take on. Celtic board have to admit as well.
Shane, what's your take on just the Eddie Howe part of it?
Well, you and I obviously correspond in text, and, mm-hmm. and you know that as far back as April, I was saying I was for calling his bluff mm-hmm. and giving him a deadline and saying, if the deadline passes and you can't give us a positive answer, then we move on to plan B. And I think the problem is we didn't have a plan B because for whatever reason, they were so obsessed with Eddie Howe. And I have to say, part of the thing that shocks me here is virtually everybody of my acquaintance was so confident that June the 1st was going to be the day that Eddie Howe signed. Everybody you spoke to, or certainly everybody that I spoke to, had said June the 1st is the day. And when June the 1st passed and went on to June the 2nd, it was a horrible feeling of this isn't going to happen here. And, you know, the whole idea of getting rid of Neil Lennon in February, it was to have a new manager in place for the start of the season and hopefully have a transition over the summer period that we could hit the ground running. And we're in a position now that I genuinely despair. Because I don't see how anybody, considering the ins and outs in terms of transfers that we're going to need to have in the next 4, 5, 6 weeks, you know, before the season starts for real, and we're going to be behind the curve again. And it's just absolutely, I think, just to say what Sean said there, it's rank amateurism by the board, by Lowell, by, I mean, Dominic Mackay has... I think this was Dom's man, to be honest. And I think that he's getting a wee bit of an easy time here because people see Lowell as being the sort of hooded claw baddie at Celtic Park. And Dom's the new guy, the new broom that's going to sweep clean. And I have to say that whether it's Lowell or Mackay or a mixture of both, it's totally unacceptable.
To be fair to Dom, he's not... If a PLC who's got a new CEO in a transition with the existing CEO, the new CEO is not going to be making any formal decisions on stuff.
Surely he was consulted though, Harry. You know what I mean?
Oh, he would have been consulted, but this is 100% Dermot Desmond. This is 100% uh-huh. Dermot Desmond stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that leads me on to another worry I have is that. I wonder now, is Dermot Desmond our biggest barrier to progressive solutions in the club, because he's constantly got that one eye on the English Premiership, hasn't he? He's constantly waving from the window at the EPL. Oh, you know, we'll get Eddie Howe, he's from the Premiership, or we'll get Roy Keane, everybody in England knows him. I worry that he is the tail that's wagging the dog right now.
Well, on your point saying about everybody saying the 1st of June, I mean, that was the thing. I heard somebody sent me a podcast, funnily enough, the week before Howe pulled out of it, the thing, and it was a couple of journalists saying, oh, Celtic could be briefing the press. Well, anybody who speaks to any journalist in Scotland will tell you that the biggest bugbear they've got is that Celtic speak to nobody. All, and this is the thing that's confusing about this. All the chat was coming directly from Eddie Howe's people. It was Eddie Howe's agents who were telling the press that the deal was done, that he was definitely coming, that they were relaxed about it. It was Celtic speak to nobody. This was all 100%. I mean, I was speaking to people who were doing things like phoning me straight after they were off the phone to Eddie Howe's agents, saying, you know, Celtic fans need to calm down because Eddie Howe's people are all completely relaxed about this. It's definitely happening. This is, you know, this is a situation. Eddie Howe had got all the videos. And so getting back to a couple of your points, Andy, this is what confuses me about it. Eddie Howe had got all the videos. Eddie Howe had actually been recommending players. The guy Kerr at St Johnstone. Celtic have made inquiries about the guy Kerr. I don't really know him. The guy Kerr at St Johnstone.
Jason Kerr,
that's it. Based on Eddie Howe's recommendation from watching Scottish football, he'd watched Rangers against St Johnstone and had been really impressed, and had then gone away and done some scouting stuff on him and had recommended. This is how bonkers the whole thing is to me. That if absolutely everything that's been coming out was only from Eddie Howe's people,
where'd it all go wrong?
How did it get to this point?
Could it be the situation, and this is my big worry, that they tried to inflict Kennedy and Strachan on Howe, and Howe wanted his own backroom team?
No, Howe was given carte blanche to get his own backroom team.
Right.
He could have as many of his own backroom people as he wanted.
But did he have to keep Kennedy and Strachan in some capacity?
No.
No, okay.
That was my worry, Saint. And I still worry that that's what we'll end up being left with.
No, I agree. I think now they'll still be there. I think under Postecoglou they'll still be there. I just find, Andy, the whole Howe thing completely baffling. When it then came out that Ancelotti was off to Real Madrid and the Everton job became available and Howe's an Everton fan, that then sort of made sense that maybe that was the thing that at the last minute did it, but he doesn't look like he's going to be getting the Everton.
No. It's really, really strange. And I think, like, it's embarrassing the club putting a statement out about not getting Eddie Howe. And obviously they tried to disguise what's really gone on by saying that something happened out with their control and out with Eddie Howe's control. But obviously people want information, so they want to know why, because people were so sure that he would be coming. I mean, to add to your comments, Brian, I mean, he supposedly spoke to a couple of the players who were leaving. And I imagine that one of those was Scott Brown. So, again, that was something that I picked up on and thought, well, yeah, I'm completely relaxed, he'll be coming. You don't get into that kind of minutiae of kind of like shadow managing the squad and then suddenly turn around and say, well, it's all off.
I don't think this is a deciding factor, but I do also know he phoned Dermot Desmond the day after Peter Lawwell's house was firebombed.
Mm.
Yeah.
For me, there's two aspects to it. And I don't know your thoughts, Sean. There's two aspects to it. Is one, I could understand, see if we'd cleared out the board, mm-hmm. and getting back to your point, saying about Dom being the new guy and being completely naive about football, I could understand the principle of they were too naive. They trusted a guy's word and they took him at his word. And so they just, you know, gave him the time that he needed. But if you ever speak to people inside Celtic, they will tell you terrible tales of how dreadful football people are for going back on their word. I mean, so I don't know if I think I've said this in the podcast before. Dwight York was in Celtic Park to sign for Celtic. Mm-hmm. The deal was on the table and him and his agent asked for a bit of time and space in the room they were in to go and talk about the deal. And then people came back in the room and then they left and then said, no, he was signing for whoever he signed for. I can't even remember.
Blackburn Rovers or something.
May have been. And Celtic subsequently discovered, and you know how when you've sent a number of faxes, when you do some stuff on a printer or something like that, you'll then get a printout of stuff that's happened on that machine, you know, maybe a day later. Yeah. Celtic subsequently discovered that he had faxed his agreement to the Blackburn deal from inside Celtic Park. Right. So the point being, that's what football people are like. They would shaft a granny for a pound, you know, right. So then that makes Celtic's trust in Eddie Howe without a signature on a piece of paper even more baffling to me.
Yeah.
Because they're not naive to it. Like I say, if there'd been a clear out and Dom was the only guy in town, then the excuse would be Dom didn't realise how football people stab you in the back. But if you speak to anybody at Celtic, they will tell you tales like the Dwight York one. So they'll say, oh, football people, you can't trust them. So that makes it even more baffling, don't you think, Sean?
The information you're revealing to me there has just confused me even more. I initially thought it was Eddie Howe dropping a bollock and just not wanting to come up, just not fancying it anymore. But again, from my understanding is he'd been courted from November, if I'm not mistaken. He'd been approached in November. You're telling
actually,
me...
Sorry, actually in November he said... No.
And then obviously maybe New Year he's changed his mind.
Yeah, once Lennon went, they went back to him and he changed his mind.
Okay. That makes a little bit more sense. But if you're telling me that he's scouting players, he's talking to existing players, he's quite clearly in constant contact with the board, a direct line to the board as well, and then it just all collapses. I am utterly confused then. I truly don't know what to make of it. But it comes back to my original point as well. If you want this guy, you'll go out and get him. We are not strangers to recruitment processes, lads, are we? If an organisation wants you, they will go out and get you and make you sign the paper and you are theirs, and blah, blah, blah. I don't understand what was the reticence there. Why did Celtic allow themselves to be strung along then? The point remains.
So the other thing for me, Sane, is not just that we don't have a manager, because obviously modern 21st century football where you're scouting players all over the world and there's so much involved for the manager in the day-to-day stuff, you need more than, you know, it's not the days of Clough and Taylor, you need more than a couple of human beings in it. We also got rid of our head of recruitment back at the end of March.
Mm-hmm.
So not only, getting back to your point of the ability to pull all this together in such a short period of time, we've also got, you know, when a manager turns up, I'm expecting Postecoglou to have an understanding of world football, but I'm not expecting him to have spent the last 3 months analysing players exactly in our budget and who are around and that we can make get available for us, etc. But what we'd expect if we had a head of recruitment in there is if a set of files on players that we can immediately turn around to and go, okay, we've been scouting these guys, what's your thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think on the fact that we also don't even have a head of recruitment?
I find it strange that we're actually letting players go, in as much as there was talk in the papers the other day that we're getting £2 million for Jack Henry, which in my eyes is a good deal. We've let Klamala go for 3.5. We let Elhamid wanted back to his homeland. We get 700,000 for him, and then Frimpong got sold for 11.5. So that's a fairly big chunk of money in anybody's book. And you wonder who's making those decisions, because clearly the Frimpong thing was too good to refuse. We're not in a position that we can refuse money like that. But some of the other players that have been leaving, I have to say that I'm happy to see the back of them, because I don't think they were very good. But it begs the question as who's taking these decisions? Because if you don't have a director of football and you don't have a recruitment manager or whatever term you want to use, then, you know, the argument should be that nobody gets to leave until the new manager comes in and makes a judgment on them. So I really don't know how to answer that, because it just appears to me that that Lowell or somebody is Lowell has been pulling his strings for the last 10 years. Let's face it, he makes the decisions. He certainly makes the big decisions. But to answer your question, I'm not sure. I don't know where we go for here, because as you say there, you know, my mind goes back to when we brought in Wim Jansen fairly late in the day. But at least we had Jock Brown there as a director of football, and he was making progress with deals, so that when Wim Jansen arrived, you know, Henrik was one of them. Stephen Mahe, you'd Craig Burley, you'd Darren Jackson, Jonathan Gould, all come in very, very quickly. So it's obvious to everybody that these deals were in process. And all it took was Wim Jansen to say, yeah, I've had a wee look, I fancy them, that's okay. I really don't know where we go for here.
See, you also had Davey Hay, who was a key scout then as well. So you had a really good infrastructure existing already. We don't have that. We don't have anybody in any of those positions. It's the cart before the horse. It's ridiculous. And then it honestly feels as if the walls have caved in, doesn't it? There's simply no infrastructure there to support a proper, solid football club, you know?
You made a comment, Andy, about making a statement, and this is the thing I found unusual. I mean, under Fergus, we spent a whole summer trying to get Houllier, and we didn't, and at the last second we brought in Wim Jansen. And then we spent a whole summer trying to get in Egil Olsen, and we didn't, and at the last second we brought in Joe Venglos. And I know from speaking to, I spoke to Steve McGowan, who was editor of the Celtic View when Venglos came in, and he said that literally he got Ellen O'Neill, who's one of the secretaries, walking down the corridor and knocked on his door and said, press conference in an hour for the new manager. Who is it? I can't tell you. I mean, so that's how it was, you know, in terms of last second announcements. I found it odd based on previously we've never said stuff when we've gone after someone and then we've not got them. What do you think the thinking was behind saying, yes, we did try to get Eddie Howe and he's not coming? Andy, what do you think?
Well, I'm actually baffled by that statement. You know, it just adds to the ridiculousness of it in terms of you saying Celtic say nothing. So if Celtic say nothing, why did they come out and make such a kind of public statement about Eddie Howe? And it was just like pouring petrol on the fire, really. I mean, I think that's where, you know, collectively the support just, you know, the anger and the frustration just kind of welled over at that point. I mean, obviously there were a few rumours beforehand. I think what it's pointing to me is, and it's interesting that you're talking about a management model from the mid-90s. And I've got the impression over the last few weeks, and I've done, you know, Harry, I've done some work around football club management structures, organisation structures, and it seems to me like Celtic's organisation structure is in the dark ages, both on the field and off the field. And one of the reasons why I was interested in Eddie Howe was, I mean, obviously there's no guarantee of success with any manager, And some people were sceptical, and the Burnley example is a good one. But I was kind of resigning myself to saying, do you know what, if he comes up and he brings his team, we will professionalise the whole of the backroom stuff on the playing side. And we've got Dominic McKay coming in as the new chief executive. He's not been involved in football. So he, by definition, if he's got anything about him, he will go and look at modern administration structures for football clubs, which he doesn't need to go very far to look at those. So I was kind of thinking to myself, well, actually, this could turn out as a double positive for us. But I think what we've seen is we've just seen literally kind of 6 months of a club that's managerially lost its way on and off the park. The disconnect with the support is, well, it's just very, very low. And you can see that from kind of almost across all the strata of the support. You know, there are always going to be groups of supporters who have different views and different feelings about the club. But it just seems that there's just so much scepticism and, yeah, there's a lot of anger and frustration about. So for me, it's about...
Sorry,
it's okay, just finish. For me, it's about modernising the football club and having it run properly and actually having some kind of connection again with the support. The PR and communication has been absolutely abysmal.
Do you trust the current board to get us out of this, mess then?
No, because the non-exec directors, the chairman, should have been replaced a long time ago. They've literally turned it in to the little club that they want it to be for themselves. Where what kind of scrutiny goes on at board meetings with those directors, and what kind of value added are they bringing? I really shouldn't bring up value added, but you know, what are they bringing to the table? Because to me, it looks as though it ended up with Peter Lawwell, who is known for being a micromanager, having a board that was completely benign, so he could more or less do what he wanted. And I think the fact that there was such a long handover tells you everything about Peter Lawwell's management style, because probably a lot of it is all in his head and in his desk, and he's not empowered people across the club to manage their departments and their areas of responsibility. That's my tuppence worth.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, we've as Lowell and Desmond created a culture of complacency within the club, all the evidence points to yes. And as you two boys have mentioned before, non-execs are meant to be critical friends, essentially, aren't they?
Yep.
At board level. Do you see Brian Wilson being a critical friend? I don't.
No.
Not in a million years.
No.
It's a Politburo, isn't it? They're all patting each other on the back and saying, well done, lads. Not a great job.
The thing that worries me about the board is, let's take Brian Wilson as an example. I'm not pointing at him specifically, but he was brought onto the board for political influence in an advisory capacity. Now, when he was brought onto the board many, many years ago, he had influence and he could advise.
Yeah.
Now, to be frank, Brian Wilson's in the periphery of politics these days. His contacts have long gone. The Tony Blair era finished 12, 15 years ago. So having him on the board doesn't make any particular sense at that point, especially, and I'm not being ageist here, but you do get to an age that you I think he's 73, that you think, well, really, what can you bring to the table at that age? So really what they should be doing is, if you want political influence, there must be somebody within that SNP government who is pro-Celtic. I mean, Brendan O'Hara apparently it was involved in some of the fanzines and is a notable MP these days.
Hamza Youssef is a Celtic fan.
Absolutely. So you know the point I'm making here. Bring somebody on board who has current influence and who can advise you and what's happening in government circles, because Brian Wilson's out of the loop. He's yesterday's man. So I think the only reason why some of those directors are currently on the board is they quite like the wee seat that they get and the nice meal they get before the matches. And when things were going well and you were getting quadruple trebles in a nine in a row, that must have been a great gig. But really, when the going get tough and we really needed them to come on board and take action, they were posted missing.
And they really didn't like the amount of scrutiny they've had to handle lately as well. We did have, Baron Livingston on the board?
Mm-hmm. Ian Livingston.
Yeah. I don't know how much use he was. I don't think he's on the board anymore, though, is he?
He's
gone now. So. But yeah, I mean, if you're going to go for political influence and non-execs, like you point out, saying the new Labour age went away a long time ago. Yeah, we should be appointing people with direct influence then. If you're going to go for a democracy, then go for it.
To be fair to Ian Livingston was on the board for about the amount of time that a non-executive director should be on a board. you should be on for about 3-4 years because the problem is this is what you do for a living, Andrew. This type of corporate governance advisement is the problem of being a NED for too long is you then. By default, because all humans would be like this, you build personal relationships with the executives that you're supposed to be scrutinising. And the longer that you're doing that, the more difficult it is for you to be, I mean, unless you don't like them, which is, you're probably going to leave because you don't like the people you're there with. It's going to be impossible for you to have that level of scrutiny with people because it's just human nature.
Harry, can I add a wee bit onto that there? Because do you not think it's the case with some Celtic websites who have become too close to the club and don't take a critical viewpoint the way that I believe a website should, because there's two or three of them out there that basically just draw the party line, and every time that they put something out in social media, I actually have blocked a couple of them because I'm just sick of the level of sycophancy that they're putting across.
No, to be fair, as a supporter, you can be as sympathetic or agitative as you want against the board. A supporter can decide to do fan media and can be as sycophantic or critical as they want. To be fair to them, and the issue for me is more getting back to Andy's point of. I mean, the phrase I've used before is we've got an analog board in a digital age. Mm-hmm. The world is such a different place to where it was 20 years ago. And nothing against age, because every single person on this podcast is
mature.
has become more mature. Yeah, some of us more mature than others. Yeah. I'm at that point now. If I plan to lift to 100, I've got marginally less time left than I've had in the bag. So age shouldn't be a barrier to stuff. But as you said, who was it said? It's like a Politburo. For me, the issue is you've got Tom Allison, who's mid-70s and has been on the board for 20 years. You've got Ian Bankier, who's been the chairman for how long, Andrew? Is it 11 years?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
11 years for Ian Bankier. You've got Brian Wilson. You got Michael McDonald, this, and obviously Dermot himself. This isn't being particularly critical of them. It's people. It's just the principle of good corporate governance says you don't have that. And the benefit of having that 3-4 year, you get people coming from other businesses in who bring fresh
ideas
or a fresh outlook, or are you sure that's the right way to be doing things? Mm-hmm. Peter, has there not been an involvement in footballing thought processes? Because it might, you don't have to do it in an aggressive, confrontational fashion. Say, in our business over here, we've evolved and we're now doing it this way.
Let's look at Bankier, for example. As Andy says there, he's been the chairman for 11 years. Bankier could turn in and say, hold on a wee minute, lads. I was there for nine in a row, and I gave you four I gave you the quadruple treble, four trebles in a row. Now, my criticism of that would be that when Rangers went out of business in 2012, that we had our and they come back in a new mode, and they were always going to come back into the SPL under that new mode. We had our foot in their throats, right? And you know, it's unforgivable. And what has happened in the last, the change and the balance in power in the last 4 years in particular. So if Bankier was to turn around and say, hey, I gave you 9 in a row, my reply to that would be, it should have been 12 or 13 in a row, frankly, because of the advantage that we had in every aspect, and you allowed that to be whittled away.
See if Ian Bankier was to turn around and say that to me, I would equate that with Bob Kelly saying, we won you a European Cup. You know, it completely neglects to mention the role of the management and the players in that respect. And getting appointments right. They have not done that lately. They're in complete dereliction of duty.
What I can't work out, I'll pick up on Saint's point about Bankier. I can't work out with Bankier. I've been at events when he's been there, and he's got no charisma, no character at all, and you don't feel that he's got. You never see anything passionate from him about the club, rightly or wrongly, what I equate him with is previous chairman, and Brian Quinn took a lot of stick, but one of the things that you got the impression with Brian Quinn that he did, and this is why some supporters fell out with him when he started to try and manage the debt. But actually, you got the impression that as the chair, he actually scrutinised what Lowell did, and he scrutinised what the club performance was.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that Bankier does none of that. So the thing is, if they just want a figurehead type of chairman, then get somebody with a bit more character and charisma. You know, if they don't want to do the scrutiny thing, I mean, they should do, but if they don't want to, then get somebody who's a bit more high profile, and kind of like warms to the support and has a connection with the support. But we don't get either from Bankier.
Andy, Brian Quinn spoke to the supporters as if they were grown-ups as well.
Yeah.
And he was very good at explaining things. And, okay, the support didn't always agree with him at times, but they understood where he was coming from. Do you get that impression of me and Bankier? No, not in a million years.
So I did a heated debate with someone who was being defensive of the board, because I was saying a good non-exec director actually shouldn't, because this person was saying, well, would you walk away from being on the board? And my point was, a good non-executive director should actually be saying, I've been here long enough, guys, I'm off.
Yeah.
And if he's not capable of saying that, he shouldn't be a non-exec director in the first place, because the whole point of a non-exec director is to ensure good corporate governance of the club. So if he's observing that nobody's asking him to leave as part of that good corporate governance, a good non-executive director should be at that point putting their hands up. One thing that might explain, Andrew, I want your thoughts on this. One thing that might explain the longevity of Bankia, I'm led to believe that for the last 2 years, he's been, best way to put it, keeping the seat warm for Peter Lowell to step in. I haven't finished.
Yeah.
The next bit's really important, and that Peter Lowell said no, and that is part of the reason why Bankier's been there for 2 years longer. That actually Peter Lowell said that was not appropriate because it would be poor corporate governance for him to step into that position.
Absolutely.
So my understanding, that's part of the reason for Bankier being there for an extra couple of years, because actually they didn't want somebody coming in for 2 years then leaving because, hey, Peter wants the gig. Apparently Peter Lowell has specifically said, no, it wouldn't be good for me to be around.
Well, that's a positive then. That is a positive, because that that has been doing the rounds a little bit, and that was a worry of mine, that he wouldn't make the kind of clean break. That's why I was worried about the period of the handover being so long. Yeah, Bankia needs to go. They just need to sort out the board. They just need to get some fresh blood in. They've only brought one new director in, and that was, can't think of her name.
Is it the female?
Brown. Brown, that's it. Sharon Brown.
And they only did that because they would have been getting some red lights on their dashboard about corporate governance and not having any women on the board.
So, no diversity.
Absolutely saying. So that's why she was brought in. But I should imagine that, you know, she's obviously quite successful in her own field, but I should imagine that, again, she's probably quite benign, and doesn't really have much input. Just to finish, the embarrassing thing for me is that those directors who should have stepped down years ago, and now it's embarrassing at the AGM having them renewed for a further year, you know, with 99.5% of the shareholders, mm-hmm. which effectively is Dermot Desmond's block vote, you know. So it's and it's not actually Dominic Mackay's job to sort the board out as the chief exec. It is literally the chairman, and obviously given the shareholding, Dermot Desmond is always going to have a say in that. But it's as though it's just not being addressed.
I was going to say, here's a nightmare scenario for you, Lou. Say Bankier does leave and Lowell feels impaled
obligated.
Persuaded, to take on the chairmanship because nobody else will or nobody else is capable or something like that. You know, I don't think we're out of the woods there in that particular regard.
I have to say, I would be utterly stunned if Peter Lawler went straight onto the board.
Yeah. But you were utterly stunned when Neil Lennon became manager.
Well, but I didn't say that the club wouldn't do it. I was just utterly stunned because I thought it was the wrong appointment.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if Peter Lawler retained some or in 6 months' time was involved in some role at the club only because of his involvement in the European what's it called, the club association, European club ECA, I think it is, European club
ECA. Yep.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if he's, because by all accounts he's very well thought of across Europe and the clubs all know him. So there is an element of the club would be crazy to let that level of direct influence in European decision making disappear completely. But I don't think he's got any appetite to hang about the club in the next wee while.
No, but Brian Quinn was he was on the UEFA Finance Committee after he'd stepped down as chairman of Celtic. So it's still possible for people like Peter Lowell to hold those kind of roles in European football without having an attachment to his old club.
How many shares has Peter Lowell got in Celtic?
For some reason, I want to say 200,000, which is quite considerable.
In percentage terms, Andrew, what would that be?
It'll be less than 0.5%, way less than 0.5%. None of the board have got substantial shares. There's only Dermot Desmond. I think that's right, isn't it, Harry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the last was he ever on the board? Yeah, I think he was ever on the board. Chris Traynor has about 10.
He was on the football club board.
He was on the football club board. That's it. Yeah, he had about 10-12%. He was the next biggest shareholder to have anything, and he stepped away five, six years ago. So there's really only, in terms of major shareholders connected to the board, there's really only Dermot.
What sort of percentage does Dermot have,
share-wise? He can't go over 30. Is that right?
Yeah, they got special dispensation when they had the went down to Lennox Town share issue. Was that 2005?
About then, yeah.
Yeah. So they got special dispensation to allow him to underwrite the share and take his shareholding above the 30% threshold without having to make a formal offer to all the rest of the shareholders. So he currently owns about, I think it's 40%. So it's another misnomer when people say Dermot Desmond's Celtic's owner. He's not the owner. And he never has been. And for as long as it's a PLC, he never will be. Now, the other thing that is going on in the background, which the Celtic Trust have got a lot more information on, is that Celtic have actually dodged their duties on the shareholder register. So that in total, you'd be interested in this, Ian, there's about 25,000 shareholders still. But about 20% of those are lost shareholders. So they can't be contacted because they bought shares in the original share issue. And in some cases, they were bought by supporters clubs that are no longer in existence. So there's all kinds of shareholdings across in the States. So various supporters clubs. Some of the big supporters clubs like Bramalee in Canada. And the club, as a PLC, should actually be trying to do everything they can to make contact with those shareholders, locate where those shares are, and get in touch with whoever owns the shares, or if they kind of they've fallen into abeyance. As it turns out, the Celtic Trust have got the shareholder register and they are currently trawling through that register trying to contact shareholders because the club won't do it.
Well, here's a funny thing, because my dad died in recent years and my father-in-law died as well, and they had small shareholdings, very small, but nevertheless, we haven't, those shares would actually fall to me probably, and I've not done anything about that. So that's a good example of shares that are lying defunct and aren't being used in the proper manner.
Yeah, exactly right, sir. That's exactly what's happened. But this, I do know the trust have approached the club about that, and the club just they won't carry out the responsibilities in that sense.
What are the repercussions for not following that particular line?
Well,
they're not discharging that duty.
Well, ultimately, they're. I mean, it's probably I don't know how major a rule it is, but they're falling foul of their responsibilities as being on the AIM stock exchange. So, and you have to remember that actually, Celtic themselves have to have financial advisors as part of being a PLC. And any shareholder has the right to go and speak to those financial advisors about the conduct of that PLC.
And that's one of the things, Andy, that frustrates me sometimes with supporters. And to be fair, and I'm not meaning this in a "oh, I know" and people don't. If I get annoyed in everything in life where we now have in my phone, I have access to all information ever known to man. So I get annoyed with everything in life when people, you know, "well, I didn't know what I was voting for when I voted Brexit." Well, come on, you know, you could have spent 2 minutes Googling it, for goodness, you know. So I do get frustrated with people who say claim ignorance on everything, but I get annoyed when people have a go at the guy who stands. Not that this happens, actually. This is one of these apocryphal tales that never really takes place. The guy who phones up, who stands up at the AGM and says the pies are too cold, right? Because my argument would be, see if that's what matters to that guy. He has every right to stand up at the AGM and say the thing that bugs me most about the club is the pies are too cold, and the ignorance of some fans online for having a go at that guy. Mm-hmm. How superior do you think you are that your question to the board is more important than that guy's question to the board? So people are quite entitled to ask whatever question they want. But equally, I get very frustrated when people talk about the inability to go to the AGM. Just go and buy a couple of shares. I don't know if you agree with me, Andy. I think there's a lot of, and as I say, this is not a patronising thing. I think it's just in general. I think there's a lot of ignorance about out there about how easy it would be to become a shareholder and then turn up at the AGM. Because one of the things I'll say to people when they're having a go is, don't piss in the wind of Twitter. If you're bothered about it, go and buy a couple of shares and go to Celtic Park at the next AGM. Obviously, COVID preventing at the moment, but
yeah, I think there is something in that. I think the thing for me though is, and Saints illustrated it perfectly through his late dad. You know that effectively, you know, people bought shares not because they were interested in shares, mm-hmm. And investments or anything like that. They bought them because they wanted to support the club financially, and it was nice to be able to say, I've got some part ownership in the club that I support and love. And for me, that is what the vast majority of people did when the share issues took place in the 90s. But what I found slightly worrying at one level, and it's corporately negligent at another, is that the club now is a PLC, are trading on those shareholders' goodwill, that they just stay in the background and don't even bother to talk about the cold pies, never mind anything else. So, and to me, that's wrong, particularly when the club kind of, you know, gives us, you know, it's kind of virtues of being a Celtic family. You know, well, you don't do that to members of your own family, where you know that they're ostracised and you know that they've been cut off, but you don't do anything about it.
Well, I think the Celtic board have been very complacent about the sport for a long time, Andy, and like I said earlier, chickens are coming home to roost, aren't they? You know.
But that's the thing, Sean. I mean, my gut feel, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have a conversation with Peter Lawwell around the time of the eight, when we'd made eight in a row, and he just turned 60 actually. So my gut feel on from that and various other things is, I think the club were always planning a change in terms of the football structure and moving. I think they had an appreciation, maybe not a thorough grasp of how bad it was, but they had an appreciation of my phrase about they were an analogue club in a digital world. Mm-hmm. My frustration with it is, I really, really think they thought, if we just need to get through to 10 in a row.
Yeah.
And once we've done that, then we can look at all these changes that we need to make. Yeah. And the complete disaster of this season, then my frustration would be the complete disaster of this season. Why didn't you go with the playbook of what you're planning to do anyway and just bring it forward? Just bring it forward to January instead of waiting till June to do it. And obviously Dominic Mackay was part of that, but it just... I just don't think they realised how deep-rooted the problems have been.
There's two facets to that, Harry, is that we've got a board of... Well, right now, we've got a board that are full of scared old men. That's one side of it. And they are panicking. They are absolutely panicking. They don't know which way to go. The other side is there's no connection with the club support whatsoever, not in any substantive sense. You've got JP Taylor, who's the only supporter liaison. I think that's the proper title, yeah. You go to the Bundesliga and they've got four on average, four or five. A club like Celtic, with its global fan base, should be having at least four or five supporter liaison offices.
We've got two.
too.
Yeah, we've got a disabled support liaison officer as well.
Well, my
I'm not defending having to. I'm just saying we've got to, just to get it factually right
But I'm saying more than two.
Before somebody tweets in.
My original point remains, and you know, many hands make light work, in that sense as well. But you know, there's that point. Analog boards in a digital world, they are completely incapable of getting any point across, and they've got a real tin ear. When they've got, you know, when it comes to any sort of progressivism,
my gut feel is that Dominic Mackay, my gut feel is that he'll change all that, or at least try to change it. Whether he changes it successfully, time will tell. And of course, the challenge is you can hardly sit there with the old guy sitting next to you saying, "Oh, by the way, he's currently all pish." You know, so there is a challenge of it, but
I used to sit beside a guy when I had my season book who used to shout at people for standing up. sit down.
So we'll move on from the board stuff scene onto the manager. So Eddie Howes has said no, and we have immediately it's become clear that we've got Ange Postecoglou. So to do the 1986 only an excuse scene, Ange Postecoglou, what do you think about that?
Well, I've read a fair bit about him in the last couple of weeks since his name. I have to say, I'm going to be honest here, I'd never heard of the guy. He certainly wasn't in my radar. I've read a wee bit about him, and I like the cut of his jib. I like what I hear. I like the fact that he seems to have a formula, an idea of how he likes his teams to play. So I would be happy to see him come as manager, in as much as I would rather have someone like him who's coming from, and I don't want to be disrespectful here, but he's not coming from one of the major leagues in the world. And he also isn't being Australian. It's not a notable soccer country, so he's coming from a background that's pretty humble in a footballing aspect. However, I believe that if he's dedicated and he is he is ambitious, then this could be a very interesting appointment for Celtic. The thing that I think is holding him back a wee bit is I don't think he's any great knowledge of the Scottish game. I think that can be a drawback. And also, and I know it's a bugbear here and I've already mentioned it, but I think if he inherits Kennedy and Strachan in any shape or form, then there are supporters out there who will just judge him from the beginning and won't give the guy what he deserves, which is the opportunity to make his mark. Because there's always going to, as soon as he gets a bad result, that's Kennedy and Strachan's fault. You know, so it's a tough one because as much as he wants to bring in his own men, his own backroom team, I think there does have to be somebody there who can guide him with regards to the Scottish game, because he's going to need a fair bit of guidance. But if you're asking me about him, then my gut feeling is I'm on board. And I can't say I'm excited in as much as I was excited when Brendan Rodgers came, but I think it's a fascinating appointment. And the only thing is, and my son said this actually, the potential is there for it to be a Pedro Kachina. We really need to be careful. So if you do appoint him, you need to give him full backing, and everybody has to get behind him and give the guy the opportunity he deserves to make his mark.
Sean?
Yeah, no, I lament that he's going to be labelled as second choice. But again, that's of the board's doing, not Angie's. He's a winner. He's an achiever. He's broadened horizons, as you've mentioned, Saint. He comes from a country where I think soccer, at best, is a fourth most popular sport. And he took them to the World Cup not just once, but twice. He also won the Asian Cup with them. I would possibly disagree with you in the sense that he's coming from the league he's coming from. The J League is actually quite a good league. It's a very competitive league, and he's done well there, again, all relatively speaking. But wherever he's gone, what I've really been attracted to him by is his philosophy and identity. I think the last few podcasts I've been on, Harry, I've lamented the loss of a noticeable, discernible playing identity. Celtic simply haven't had that for the last couple of years, and Postecoglou will have that in spades. But as you're mentioning, saying as well, will he be allowed to succeed? Well, never mind even the club's opponents or, you know, dare I say it, even enemies. There's an awful lot of myopia in Scottish football. Anybody foreign coming into the Scottish game is up against it from the word get-go, aren't they? And then that's even before you look at expectations that he has to deal with. Celtic is, you know, obviously it's comparable, but it's not the same in the sense that it's the same as Real Madrid. You're one draw away from a crisis, aren't you, at Celtic? You know, if he loses or draws a couple of games in succession, the knives will be out. And will the board allow him to succeed as well? Will he be imposed with Strachan and Kennedy, for example? Will he be allowed to choose his own backroom team? Will he be allowed autonomy in terms of signing targets and what have you? And even will he be allowed the tools to successfully build his team the way he wants? That's the biggest variable for me, unfortunately.
Andy, Postecoglou?
Yeah, I'm usually Mr. Optimistic, aren't I? But I've still got so many uncertainties. I mean, I'll put my cards on the table like Saint and say, you know, he wasn't on my radar either. I mean, I was conscious that Australia had done quite well in some tournaments, but wasn't aware that he was the coach. You know, I've been scrabbling around trying to gen up on him over the last few days. But I think the thing for me is that the culture of Australian Japanese football, and I do watch a little bit of Australian football actually, but it's completely different from Scottish football. Now you could argue that when people like Brendan Rodgers came in, he had no experience of Scottish football, and to a certain extent he kind of walked it, and that was very much through the coaching that he brought to the game, and it worked. Although it's arguable that by the time he was leaving, some of his tactics and his approach had gone a bit stale. But with Ange, I don't know. Nearly everything that I've read has said that he doesn't get off to the fastest of starts. Mm-hmm. Well, we all know what that means. We all know what that means for our club. If you don't get off to the fastest start, you're not going to be winning the league, and the supporters won't be happy. And I think I'd just echo what Saint and Sean have said, that, you know, if he's lumbered with Kennedy and Strachan, then I've not seen anything from them since Lennon left to make me think that they are reasonable at their jobs, never mind good. Particularly Kennedy, because Kennedy changed nothing. And if the rumours are true that Kennedy had a fallout with Lennon about what was supposed to happen tactically in games, then Kennedy did, once Lennon had gone, Kennedy did nothing to convince anyone that he's got the nous to be a good coach. So obviously I'll get behind him if he is the man, but we're really into unknown territory.
For me, it's even more baffling, I suppose, if you were putting all your eggs in Eddie Howe basket, but I would at least have a bit more comfort about Postecoglou coming in if we had the director of football stroke, sporting director, and the recruitment guys who'd been in since Christmas when Lennon had left. And you would have more comfort that, okay, this guy's coming from a foreign environment, literally foreign environment, and he's coming in. But there's going to be a guys who on day one are going to sit down and say, right, okay, this is what we've produced. This is what we're ready to go with. What are your thoughts? That would give me, so your point, Andrew, about I've read up and, you know, I'm only trying to look for positive stuff about him, and everything people talk about him as, well, the style of football you have Celtic play will be incredible. I mean, it would just be wonderful. It'll be brilliant to watch. But every single person then also chucks into the mix. But it's a bit of a slow start because he has to transform the players from the existing style into this style, which is an incredibly high-pressing style. And as you say, Wim Jansson was very lucky. I mean, people on his, everybody will remember from the time on his second, after his second league game, Radio Clyde's phone in was full of people saying they wanted this guy sacked. Yeah. And social media just magnifies that level of giving, you know, to be fair, during that time, what, Clyde could accommodate 10 dissenting voices? But there was probably 10,000 dissenting voices sitting behind those 10 people who got on Clyde. Social media gives those 10,000 people a voice. So it just amplifies everything. So that's my concern, Sean.
Well, what I would say as well is I've been encouraged by the desire by a lot of Celtic fans who want to know more about this guy, and I've actually reached out to, you know, interesting and informed channels to inform their own opinion about this guy. You know, contacted Australian journalists or Australian supporters clubs down south, or down under, and are trying to make an informed basis behind this guy. But as you're alluding to, if you're having to Google the name of your prospective manager, you're up against it, aren't you? And in such an intense football environment as Glasgow is, I fear for the guy in that sense.
That's where I'm at with it, is that, okay, what's happened has happened with Eddie Howe. But how do you go from Eddie Howe to this next candidate who, let's be frank, most of the sport have not heard of? Mm-hmm. Because there's a whole myriad of managers that must be in between that scale of Eddie Howe and Postecoglou. So what's the process been that's actually said, well, all these other managerial fish in the sea, why have they been completely ignored, or have they been ignored, or, you know, there's any number of named managers that are out of work currently. Don't mention Roy Keane.
To be fair, I don't think Roy Keane was ever a serious candidate.
No, but there are plenty of managers out there who you think would understand Scottish football, even if they've not managed in Scottish football. They understand that style of play. They understand the magnitude of Celtic as a football club.
Andy, every year, ad nauseum on this podcast, we spell out what is the biggest driving force that will keep Celtic ahead of their rivals, European football, in particular Champions League participation. Yep. Therefore, in terms of job specification for future managers, European experience and success is almost a prerequisite. And every time we have a managerial appointment, we completely negate that. We go for left field appointments. We go for obscure appointments. We go for nepotism. It is absolutely bewildering every year, or every time this situation crops up. Yep. We do something completely aghast. It's frustrating, you know. And like you're all saying, there's no way I'm not going to get behind this guy if he's Celtic manager. I'll get behind him, of course I will. Yep. And his track record, like I spelled out, is really good. But I come back to the intensity of the Glasgow football environment. If you're second, you're nothing. If you're second, you're losing. And pre-season, if he's lucky, he's going to come out of isolation for pre-season. It's, oh my word.
I don't think people in England.
Champions League qualifiers as well. You know?
Well, Sean, I was about to say that because if this is such an important season, in as much as the Scottish champions got automatic entry next season into the Champions League,
the next 2 years are crucial. Same.
Absolutely. And you know, it's the ups and downs, the yin and yang. Because if we don't get there, then guess who is going to get there? And guess who's going to get the 30 million or however much it is money. And then that skews up the balance in the city with the football. And we could quickly go from being in the ascendancy to being behind them to a considerable degree. And that is astonishing to think, considering that the advantages that we've had in the last 2, 3, 5, 10 years in terms of the finances, in terms of the quality of players, in terms of the whole structure. But what concerns me a wee bit is two things. The first one is, I don't think people in England even appreciate the pressure that's on a Celtic manager. It's enormous. Because if you're down in England and you're the manager of, I mean, Brendan Rodgers is manager of Leicester and he's done really well. But if Brendan Rodgers finishes mid-table, then arguably he's had a good season. Because Leicester aren't expected to be in that top six. So, you know, he's punching above his weight in that respect. But when you come to Scotland, you know, we're in a very strange situation now. I think we're approaching the time where any manager who doesn't win the league for Celtic is going to be sacked because it's seen as unacceptable. Because as Harry said earlier, it's the pressure of those 10,000 fans who now have social media to get their point across and to complain and vent their spleen. Whereas 20 years ago, they didn't have that forum. So you know, we're in a really strange situation whereby you could end up with a new manager every single year and for the foreseeable future.
So Andy, or it's saying, one of the things we just touched on there, so we've allegedly agreed compensation terms for Yokohama, which again, getting back to Andy's point of the availability of managers, the strange thing is we've actually gone and got a manager who's at a club that's cost us money to do that. Very un-Celtic-like to do something like that. Japan's on the amber list. So if he sets off on a plane tonight, he can't be at Celtic Park until the 15th of June or the 16th of June. Saying, do you think as much to do with aesthetics, getting back to we've been criticising the messaging from Celtic, do you think they should delay the date the players are coming back from pre-season to avoid the possibility of the first day of pre-season being taken by Kennedy and Strachan from the aesthetics possession?
I really don't think we've got much of a choice because you can't delay the players in pre-season because they have to be prepared for certain dates.
But to be fair, the international players are not back. The international players are not coming back until I think it's the 5th of July. And by all accounts, this is the longest pre-season that we'll have had in about five, 6 years.
Aye, because it started in Dubai.
I know what you're getting at there, and I'm a huge...
I just mean if we... I think, sorry, Sean, just to give everyone... I think they are either back on the 14th or the 21st. I think it's round about those two. Those are two Mondays. That's right. So I think it's round about then. So I'm just wondering if it's the sort of week of the 14th and he can't be on the training ground for just 3 days, do you not just push back training just so you don't have that bad aesthetic?
Well, they've already planned games, I think, down in Wales. Against various teams, so I don't think you can. I wouldn't be advocating putting anything back. I think you know we have to be fully prepared in every way possible for the start of the season, despite the guys in international duty not coming back till a later date. So I do appreciate what you're saying there because it is not going to look good if Kennedy and Strachan take training without the manager, but it still has to be decided. Hasn't been decided yet who his backroom staff are going to be. So we have to ascertain what that is first before we can make any decisions on that front.
On a human note, despite the criticism, it's pretty awful for Kennedy and Strachan that they don't know if they've got a job in 2 weeks' time.
Mm-hmm. I think they know.
But do they know if we've not got anything formalised with the new manager?
I think that's...
They'd have gone by now.
That's not been agreed.
They'd have gone by now.
Yep.
But still haven't operated as a lame duck.
There's no ideal
situation either, is it?
Yeah, there's no squad around, so there's nothing for Kennedy or Strachan to do. So if they were going to be leaving, the board would have severed their contracts before now. That's my I don't know that, but that's my reading of the situation.
Okay, well, we've been going on long enough, and I'm wanting to try and have some positives in it. So here's one. What do you think? Just a general thing. What do you think your chances are of getting inside Celtic Park in 2021?
Good.
Yeah, I think they're pretty good.
I don't think we'll have full house for a while, but we'll definitely have supporters inside the ground. I think that the momentum behind getting spectators in the ground is now turned in our favour, so to speak, you know, inverted commas. I think the more events that I'll have, more supporters in them, they'll just grow and grow exponentially.
The one thing that aggrieves me is the Scottish Government have allowed, I think, 12,000 fans at Hampden for these European games. European Championship games. And I actually think it's despicable that they didn't allow a couple of thousand of St Johnstone and Hibs fans in for that Scottish Cup final. Because there's not a great time scale between both. And the reason why I think we will have fans back at some point is the government can't turn into the SPL and say, you're not getting anybody in next season, but we'll let 12,000 foreigners into Hampden to watch whoever's playing whoever. So I think that the Euros being at Hampden is a good thing because it forces the government's hand.
And to be fair, saying there'll be 12,000 Glaswegians will be inside Hampden.
Surely there's some supporters coming, is there no?
Yeah.
No? There's no England supporters going to Hampden.
I think England supporters might, or people within the UK, but I don't really think there's going to be any supporters from...
No, there's nobody coming from the Czech Republic or anything, I think.
Yeah, so local-based people that are going to be getting... But I get your point about...
My point stands because if she turns in and says we're letting 12,000 into Hampden, then it goes without saying that that's the starting point for...
Oh, obviously it was going to be a sensational comment from Saint there and we've lost it.
Far too controversial, isn't it?
Oh, you're back safe. We just lost you there. You were saying if she can't let 12,000 into Hampden and then not allow them into the SPL.
Yeah, what I'm saying is the starting point for negotiating attendances should be 12,000 for next season.
My gut feel is that we'll have 16,000 in the first game. That's my gut feel, and it'll be done by a ballot. And with that, I will say, gents, thanks very much.
Cheers, Harry.
Thanks.
Cheers, Sean.
Cheers, Sam.
Hope you enjoyed that from Sean, Saint, Hallboy, and myself. There will obviously at some point in an indeterminable future be more podcasts along shortly. Hopefully the work will ease a little and allow me time to record these. Meantime, there's always the Twitter space. If you go on Twitter and look at Eddie Pearson's feed, Celtic Rumours, you will see that he's trying to do Sundays. I can't make this Sunday, or by the time you listen to this, it might have been I didn't make this Sunday, whatever. Anyway, it's live, and so it can only be, it's not recorded, so blah, blah, blah. anyway, follows Eddie's Twitter and you'll see when he's doing the Spaces stuff. Enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady. That was Sean, St. Anthony and Hallboy saying goodnight and God bless. And as you heard on the podcast, I expect Ange Postecoglou to be appointed very, very shortly. Still love you.